The other thing that changed my life was the year I spent at Cambridge. I learnt nothing at Cambridge because Dean, who I'd gone to work with, was completely years past his best. He was about 75. Never, I don't think I spoke to him half a dozen times in a year. He was very nice, but he never did a day's work.
He was an immunologist.
What?
An immunologist, Dean.
No, he was just a... Well, that's what he'd made his name on. He's a professor of pathology.
Yes,
But he never did anything. He was master of Trinity Hall and was keen on the rowing. But the professor of medicine was the man who changed my whole career, because he was an elderly man whose room was next to my research lab, and he and I had tea together every day for a year, and he got very fond of me, this old chap. He was a most delightful. He was the type of man that you couldn't help liking. He was an absolute perfect gentleman to his fingertips. And they always appointed somebody like that as Regius Professor at Cambridge. He did no work. He only conducted the final MD examination. That was his total work for the year. He was retired from Harley Street. And he it was, as I tell you, in the last week I was there, sent for me, and I suppose working in the pathology department, he'd met a lot of very good scientists, and he was miles ahead of the time of thinking about things, and he sent for me, and he simply said, I don't see any future for clinicians who haven't had a training in some scientific subject, didn't matter what it is, in order to learn the meaning of control and that critical spirit which is so lacking among clinicians. And he forced me to go against Sir Edmund Spriggs's advice, and when I turned to Edinburgh to apply for a clinical post, and I was appointed first to Leith and then the Royal Infirmary. But if it hadn't been for him, I'd have been a pathologist all my life. But I think if you say how that's undoubtedly why I was made Professor of Medicine, the youngest in Scotland, in Britain, and then the first whole time chair in Britain, was because I had this mixture of clinical and research experience. And that appealed to MacLeod of insulin fame. I'm sure he was the man who made the court appoint me. But I think the reason of any success I had after then, of course, it was like that Miss Jean Brodie. I was in my prime then. It was that I have a natural bent for picking winners. If you think of the professors of medicine all over the world who have been my house physicians, they're in dozens, absolutely in dozens. And I have a natural ability for, saying that's going to be a jolly good chap. And all these chaps like Robson and, Irving and Flenley and all the whole lot of them, they've all been house physicians to me. And it was the same in Aberdeen. I had... that nice chap from the postgraduate hospital, he started with me, who was the professor of medicine there, who was up in Edinburgh the other day at the Royal Society, opening the Royal Society's rooms. I can't remember my own name.
I don't remember his name at the moment.
Well, but at any rate, he was my first assistant, and then Hill was my second assistant. The first four assistants I appointed all got chairs almost within a few years. And it was the same when I got down here. I appointed some very good men to those northern groups of hospital. They've done awfully well,
They've done extremely well.
Well, if it wasn't for them, I don't know where Edinburgh would be. They really are. They're very keen on research.
Yes. Do you think Edinburgh's doing enough research at the present time?
No, I don't. It's most disappointing. It's absolutely disgusting. It's probably because we've written too many books and there are too many committees. But we've gone into a bad... I think every university goes into a bad... flow. I think the teaching is as good as anywhere in the world, but we've gone into a very bad flop in the clinical research, very bad. I mean, Glasgow's miles ahead of us.
There's more coming out in the journals from Glasgow at the moment than from Edinburgh, I think.
10 times as much.
Yes.
10 times. It's really very disheartening to read the journals. Edinburgh's very bad. But I was not only able to pick winners. It was the same with all these books I wrote. I had a capacity of picking the people who were writing different sections, the right chaps to do it. And I was a very fortunate temperament I've got. I'm a very determined man, but I don't ever get angry. And the result was, though I always got my way in the end, I always got it by friendly conversations instead of fights. So I never had any trouble either with my staff or with my different commentators in these books.
You didn't have to have any rows with your contributors
never,
to your
never
books.
Once, yes. No. Well, that's 30 splendid. Years.
Tell me, Sir Stanley, what was the most happy experience in your academic life?
Well, I can certainly tell you that. There were two things that I'll never forget, because I do think they really were worthwhile. The one was, when I went to Aberdeen, we were stationed at Woolman Hill. This was the oldest teaching hospital in Scotland. It was 200 years old. Most dreadful accommodation. There was no research accommodation. And I got them to build hutted accommodation so that McMichael, John McMichael, was the first chap who came to me, and then Hill, and then Fullerton, and all these people that you've known all over the world. Well, I was on a committee. Now, you've got to remember the vast difference between those days of 1930, before the health service came in, when it was a voluntary hospital. The citizens of Aberdeen District had raised more than £1 million to build this new hospital. They didn't have to. Nobody had a word to say except the Board of Management. And they appointed a very high-powered committee, a committee of all kinds of experts, of which I was a member for 6 years. And we had to ask nobody about what we were going to do except the Board of Management. And so we did as much in 5 years, because it was our own money, as would occur in 15 if you were doing it today with all these government committees. So I think that was a very important. And when the Queen opened this new complex of hospitals, which were the admiration of Britain, in 1935, everybody had been talking about it, and people were coming from all over the world to see them, because there were the whole lot of the hospitals with a medical school in the middle of them. So when the Queen opened that and I was finished with that committee, I was naturally very proud and pleased to be a member of such a committee. And the other thing that gave me the greatest pleasure, when I finished the last of the 7 units that I started out to develop in the municipal general hospitals in the northern, the northern hospital, the eastern hospital, and the western hospital.
This is down here in Edinburgh.
Yes,
yes, of course.
So when that was finished, I was very tired, but I was very pleased. Yes. It had been so successful. We'd got such good men in charge of these units.
Well, these were happy times. Tell me, did you have any unhappy times during your academic life?
Well, only that one year where I went nearly mad with Joe. As I've told you, we had 400 students, 8 sections of 50. How would you like to teach 8 sections of 50 every week, telling them exactly the same thing every day, not knowing anything about bacteriology either, but having to read it up in the daytime, go to the Royal Infirmary every night to learn how to stain and examine the pus under the microscope, and then repeat the same bloody thing 8 times.
This was in Edinburgh.
Yes,
after the war. When you came back.
1921. It nearly killed me.
Who helped you in these classes? You mentioned Joe.
Well, Dr. Joe, who was a graduate of the same age as myself, knew nothing either, and ended up as medical superintendent of the city hospital.
Yes.
He was really a fever man. He went from there into fevers. But neither of us knew nothing, but luckily Hadley Wright, who was the college of physician bacteriologist, and when that was open, he came over and taught the senior students, the people who had to know something. He knew we didn't try and teach anything except practical bacteriology.
Well, obviously you've had more happy times than unhappy.
Oh, that was the only. It really wasn't unhappy.
No.
It was relatively unhappy.
You probably enjoyed it for a bit
anyway.
Well,
I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. It was so boring saying the same thing and so soul-destroying.
How did the students react to it?
Well, they didn't have to. They only went once. We had to say the same thing 8 times. Mm-hmm. They only had it once. Mm-hmm. So they didn't mind it at all, because we took endless trouble with them. But they didn't mind it. They didn't know. Of course, the students hated all these clinics with 50 and 60. They had a wretched time.
Yes.
Wretched time.
Scandalous. Far too many. Mm-hmm. Well, now, could we start to ask you now, you've now retired, and when you walk back into Teviot Place and go up past the Dean's office, how do you see the changes there compared with
you don't
many
see
years
much
ago?
just walking round the court, you see nothing. But when you go inside, it's quite unrecognizable. It's so unrecognizable that, I mean, I couldn't find my way round any building in that TV place. Just the same with George Square. Derek Dunlop and I get lost. We don't know where we are with so many new buildings.
Yes.
When you go inside the buildings and see the staff and the deans,
I'm amazed at them.
Do you find that there are more people there now than what you used to deal with?
10 times.
10 times?
10 times. Now, I'll tell you another story that may interest you for this record. When I was appointed, I was wanted to be a pathologist, but a chap called Ritchie was the professor of bacteriology.
Yes.
And he took a fancy, determined that I'd be a bacteriologist. And so I was up north shooting, and he wrote and said that he'd seen Lorraine Smith, and they'd agreed that I would go as my first job in 1920 or something like that, to the Department of Bacteriology. And so I sent him a brace of grouse and said, right, I'm delighted. And he got a letter of thanks saying that unfortunately he wasn't well, but his family had enjoyed him. Before I got to end of September to Edinburgh to take my job, he was dead with cancer of the stomach. And McCartney, who was a senior lecturer, was in New York with a Bite Fellowship. And the professor was dead. And the two assistants, now that shows you the staff, that was the total staff, but a chap called Joe, who went to the city hospital, superintendent 30 years later, and myself. Neither of us knew anything. Nothing. And this is how we did it. Do you know how many students we had to teach? 440 a day.
In 1 year?
Yes, for a whole 1 year. 9 sessions a day of 2 hours we had to take in practical bacteriology. Every day of the week. It drove me completely bottom.
That's
I'd never go on with academic medicine.
Yes. 400 students.
More, 420.
420. But that constituted the whole of 1 year.
A whole of the third
it's
year.
It's not the whole of the medical intake.
No,
it's just 1 year.
That was the third year alone.
Third year alone had 420 students.
Yeah.
That is enormous.
And the reason, absolutely, but of course it was so badly run, the medical school, in the Second World War. If you were a second-year medical student, they stopped you from enlisting.
Yes.
But in the First World War, you could do as you liked. And luckily, it only lasted 4 years, or we'd have had no doctors.
Yes.
And so we had, after the war was over, the ordinary intake of 220 and 200 ex-servicemen who'd all been wounded and fighting in the trenches had come back either to start medicine or to, many of them, really, they'd be first or second year students when they went away.
Yes.
And so we had this class of 400, 9 sections of 50. And two of us, our first job, didn't know a damn thing. We used to read the stuff up all day. We went to the Royal Infirmary every evening at 6 and got the pus, you know, the gonococci or the pneumococci, learned to stain it, learned to examine it, and read it out and worked out what to tell them. And then we repeated the same bloody stuff 9 times a day for a year. And I very nearly said, that's the end of me with academic medicine. I never was so fed up in my life.
Yes. That was an ordeal.
Awful.
It must have put you off bacteriology.
Put me off everything to do with university life.
Yes, yes.
And then when it was over and I got interested in immunity and I was doing a lot of research work on it, I forgot all about it.
Yes.
And I went off to Cambridge.
Yes.
But Mackie didn't come till 2 years later.
Yes, yes.
So we had to go on with this. But McCartney came back in a year.
Yes.
So things got better in a year.
They wrote a good book between them, Mackie and McCartney.
Very, very popular. It's still published, isn't it?
Yes. It's been given another name, though. It's been called Cruikshank's Medical Microbiology.
Oh, yes.
But he's...
Oh, yes.
What did you work on when you went down to Cambridge?
What was I working on?
Mm.
Well, on immunity.
Yes.
And here's another interesting story that I've published. At Cambridge, I don't know whether I'm boring you, but at Cambridge, on one side of my room in the Department of Pathology, was Sir Humphrey Rolleston. He was a Regius Professor of Medicine, an elderly physician of 70-odd. They didn't do any work. It was just an honorary job, and he occasionally went down to Harley Street. Absolutely charming chap. Most erudite and delightful physician of the old kind. And on the left side of me was a man called Dixon. They didn't have a professor of pharmacology, they had a reader. And he was quite the most remarkable man I've ever seen. So we had tea together every day for a year. Dean was useless. I don't think I spoke to him half a dozen times in the year. He never advised me on anything. I just went on my own, doing all sorts of experiments with animals and, you know, the simple immunological work in those days. And the week I left, they both had a meeting with me. It just altered my whole life. And Sir Humphrey Rolleston, I don't know what he was. He'd taken, got to like me very much because I was the early 20s, and then he was in the 70s. But he was thinking 20 years ahead, and he said to me, "Now, look here, Stanley Davidson, you're to go back to Edinburgh next week and immediately apply for a clinical post." And I said, "Clinical post?" I said, "I'm never going to do any clinical work. I'm not well enough." He said, "You're going to do it." He said, "Because nobody who's going to be a professor of medicine in the future will ever get a chair who hasn't spent at least 2 or 3 years in a scientific department, doesn't matter what kind it is, and learning the critical attitude of the scientist as opposed to the clinician." And so he talked me into applying, and when I came back, I applied to Leith Hospital. I went on in the bacteriology department part-time, and I went to Leith Hospital as assistant physician. And what do you think Dixon said to me? My whole research work in those days, everybody like myself believed that the future of medicine depended on vaccine treatment of diseases. It had been hopelessly useless. Only for the prevention it was good. And that antibiotics were totally impossible, because the only one ever made was by Ehrlich in arsenic, and it nearly always destroyed the tissues when it tried on anything else but syphilis. And it was absolutely useless. And this man Dixon said to me, "You mustn't believe that. There's absolutely no future in bacteriology qua vaccines, except for prevention. You're just wasting your time trying to find out how to produce vaccines for treatment. The only future is in antibiotics." Now, that was 15 years before penicillin was discovered. So I came back there and gradually gave up antibiotics and went into clinical research. Now, that was a funny thing, wasn't it?
Well, it's very interesting because at the present time, people are looking for a vaccine for cancer. Some of the Swedes are, and this work has been stimulated by the studies on African lymphoma, which is where they think there's possibly a virus. But you see, if your friend Dixon is right, then this work too is probably doomed to failure, like the vaccines for other diseases.
Of course, I don't believe, you know, I've been a funny person like that. I started the first rheumatic clinic in Scotland in 1932 in Aberdeen. And I got Duffy trained as a house physician there before I brought him to Edinburgh. And there he's been working for 40 years on rheumatoid arthritis. Now, no doubt, whatever he is, he's worked hard. Every kind of method he's been using, and he's working with your friend, the professor of bacteriology.
Marmion.
Couldn't have a better chap than that, on baboons and things. And I don't think they're one step further forward about the actual cause of rheumatoid arthritis than I was in 1932. They're better in symptomatic treatment, but they don't know the cause. And I believe that both disseminated sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis are due to your tissues becoming antigenic. I don't think they're infections at all.
It's a very interesting hypothesis, and it would explain why bacteriologists and virologists have failed to identify infectious agents time and time again.
I mean, the two Dawsons working in the College of Physicians laboratory spent a lifetime on multiple sclerosis, completely useless as regards discovering the cause.
Yes, but on the other hand, the published work by Dr. Dawson, that is Edith Dawson's husband, that published monograph on the pathology of disseminated sclerosis is a classic now.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful work.
Yes, quite.
And is, I find it quoted in all learned reviews of the literature.
Yes.
I believe he died from tuberculosis and was a very brilliant man.
Did he? Yes, I don't
Did you ever know him at all?
Oh, no, I mean, of course I knew them both very well.
Yes.
But in those days, you know, that department of bacteriology ran by the College of Physicians in, you know, that little road, where the church is now.
Yes.
It really was the only, the College of Physicians laboratory was the only laboratory really doing clinical work.
Yes.
You couldn't get it done at the university.
No, why not?
It's all done there, all the bacteriology, yes, biochemistry, yes, and everything.
Colonel Harvey, I think, was what? There. Colonel Harvey.
Yes, I knew him very well.
Did you really? Yes.
Oh, I knew him well at the head of it. I forgot what his name was. He was a patient of mine. Yes. With tropical sprue. I've been interested in that disease all my life.
Yes, yes.
Tropical sprue.
Yes.
What's tropical, yes, sprue due to?
Yes.
Nobody knows.
Yes, yes. It's curious the university didn't do this sort of work then, and it was left to an outside body.
It was, but of course the university, the people had to pay for this, the College of Physicians and Surgeons who employed these men, they were all chaps from Indian Medical Services, they were,
yes,
all colonels who'd retired, and of course they got a salary of $1,000 a year, which was a lot, and then every physician and surgeon who had a private patient wanted a lab or a test on their urine or anything like that, they had to pay the college a fee.
Yes.
And that's what they did off. Well, you could hardly expect the university to accept money for investigating private patients, you see.
Yes. Could we just come back once again to this question of large numbers of students? You told us that you had 450 students in your year.
I think it was 420.
Or 420.
Mm.
Well, just now in each year we have about 150 or so.
150, yeah.
And this to us seems enormous. And yet the staff has increased very greatly. Did you have a large staff in those days to teach? As large as we have now?
Two. Myself and another chap.
Yes.
The professor was dead, and they didn't appoint Mackie for 2 years. The lecturer was in America. Two untrained people was a total staff.
Yes. And in clinical medicine, for example, in clinical medicine,
oh,
when you were professor of medicine,
miserable
did you have a big staff?
Did he have one?
Did you? Yes.
None. A professor of medicine, I was the first professor in medicine that was ever appointed to a chair with a salary in the whole of Britain.
Really?
It,
yes,
was that MacLeod of insulin fame came back to Aberdeen in an old and dying condition, and he asked the university court if it was right to pay the professor of anatomy and professor of pathology and professor of physiology a salary in which he could live and advertise the chair so as to attract people from any university in Britain. Why wasn't it right to do this with the professor of medicine, surgery, and midwifery? Now, no university in Britain did that. It was always a local man was appointed because the salary was 200 a year.
Yes.
And it took you 20 years to establish a private practice.
Yes.
So nobody ever applied, yes, from outside the town.
Yes.
Now, that was absolutely disastrous because, yes, very often there were periods when there was nobody of, yes, any distinction.
Yes.
At that time, there was nobody of any distinction in Edinburgh.
Yes.
In Aberdeen is very unfortunate. Aberdeen, they had a very good man,
yes,
who was, thought he was bound to get the chair and was really a frightfully good physician called A.G. I can't remember.
You mentioned him in your article in the Chronicle.
Yes.
You mentioned that he was there when you went,
yes,
and eventually all got on very well.
He was a magnificent clinician, yes, not for research,
yes,
but a magnificent clinician. It was very unfortunate. The desk for a change had a very good man, very bad luck on him.
Was he easy to get on with?
What?
Was he easy to get on with?
I had a dreadful time. Luckily, I can get on with almost anything.
Yes, yes.
But I used to have to go out and grit my teeth.
Yes.
I mean, it was just as difficult for him.
Yes.
He was assistant physician in my wards. Awful for him.
Yes.
10 years older, far more experienced as, yes, a physician.
Yes.
Hopelessly disappointed.
Yes.
It was awful for him. I used to keep thinking what he felt,
yes,
to try and control,
yes,
my temper.
Yes.
We never had an open row, and then luckily a physician left, and he then got wards of his own.
Yes.
And from that day onwards, things improved, and we were the greatest of friends in the end.
Well,
but I went up every fortnight when he was dying to see him from to Aberdeen from Edinburgh.
Did you really?
Every
yes.
fortnight.
Yes, yes.
I got to like him so much.
Yes. So obviously, when you started off, things were difficult, but then they improved, and once he got his own wards,
got on
very well.
Well, we had no accommodation in Aberdeen any more than we had in Edinburgh. The accommodation of all the professors in Britain outside the full-time units in London consisted of a lecture theatre and a retiring room beside the lecture theatre for the professor to take his coat off. That's all.
Yes. What size of staff do you think, under ideal conditions, should a professor of medicine have?
Well, probably the staff that Donald's had. I worked for years to get that place for him.
Yes.
And I never got it for myself. But I think he's well provided with staff, especially when Richmond was there.
Yes.
That's the sort of staff he had. And of course, Flendley is another of my health physicians. He's a very able man.
Yes.
He did a very good mixture.
Yes.
Donald, of course, has been unfortunately, he's been away far too much on that University Grants Committee.
Yes.
And the students hardly know him. And if it hadn't been for Richmond and Flendley, that apartment would have been hopeless, you know.
Yes.
I mean, the ward sisters tell me that they simply bless Richmond.
Yes.
Because no patient suffered the least bit by Donald being away.
No.
Just because he had Richmond there to look after them.
Yes. John's down in Sheffield now.
Yes, he's doing very well.
Yes, doing
He's a
doing.
Chap they might bring back here when Donald retires.
Yes, yes.
He's awfully good.
Yes, he is. Very good indeed.
Of course, you've got to make up your mind what kind of a professor do you want. I had your executive dean here talking to me and what I thought.
Archie,
and I said to him, I think you've got to make up your mind, not who you're looking for. Make up your mind what you want first.
Yes.
No good looking for anybody till you know what you want.
Yes.
I think you ought to have two people. One, a sort of Woodruff type of man, who's not really a very pleasant man in many ways, and is not very much liked by the students, and not very interested in the students.
Mm.
He's more interested in the rabbits and pigs and things. But he's the sort of chap who's liable to do something fundamental.
Yes.
Just as he has done.
Yes.
And you oughtn't to put a lot of beds in his charge. Give him a very limited number of beds and not expect him.
Yes.
To do a great deal of clinical work.
Yes.
And then your second person you want is a chap like Richmond. You must have a doctor.
Yes.
As a professor of medicine. As a chap who's interested in patients, interested in teaching, and interested in clinical research. But he mustn't pretend to be a biochemist or a physicist or anything like that. It's impossible to be both.
One of the problems is that it limits your choice. There are some very good cardiologists in Edinburgh.
Very
good nephrologists.
Very good.
Some very good experts in gastrointestinal disease. And this makes it difficult for any new professor coming.
It does, yes, and not to be sensible.
Mm.
They're all very nice chaps. They all cooperate very well with
you.
I mean, Richmond had got on well with them all. I don't see why they shouldn't.
Yes.
I don't think any of them are suitable for chairs themselves, except personal chairs.
Yes.
But I don't think any of them are the person to be a professor of medicine. I mean, to be a much wider interest than any of them have. I mean, they have a narrow but very important job to do.